From The Nation magazine, this is Start Making Sense. I'm John Wiener. Later in the show, what happened in the election in Los Angeles and Southern California? Gustavo Arellano, the LA Times columnist, will comment. But first, the Georgia Senate runoff campaign has begun. Joan Walsh has just returned from Atlanta. We'll speak with her in a minute. December 6th is the Georgia Senate runoff when our man, incumbent Senator Raphael Warnock, will face former football star Herschel Walker again. For comment, we turn to Joan Walsh. She's the nation's national affairs correspondent and author of the book, What's the Matter with White People? She covered the November 8th Georgia campaigns for the magazine from Atlanta. We reached her today back home in Manhattan. Hi, Joan.
Hi, John. Good to hear you.
Well, Raphael Warnock got 1,941,000 votes. Herschel Walker got 1,906,000 votes. That's a victory margin of 35,000 votes out of almost 4 million cast. And there were 82,000 votes for a Libertarian candidate. But, of course, now that the Democrats have carried Nevada, they will control the Senate whether or not Warnock wins the runoff. So unlike 2020, the Georgia runoff will not decide control of the Senate and, you know, the future of humanity. How will that affect Georgia voters? This is the big question everybody wants the answer to. Some say it will take the wind out of Republican sails, even if they vote for the unqualified and problematic Herschel Walker. Republicans still won't control the Senate, so a lot of Republicans will stay home for the runoff. What do you think?
I think that is more likely than Democrats staying home. I think the Democrats last week were very disappointed in Stacey Abrams losing her bid for governor by a much larger margin than she did in 2018, and were a little bit chastened by Senator Warnock getting so close to that 50% he needed, but not getting over the line. I'm talking to some people who say there's been kind of a reckoning with turnout problems, lack of enthusiasm, sketchy ground games, et cetera, to kind of make up for what happened last week and also bring Senator Warnock across the finish line. Democrats are getting clearer about why it matters so much that they win that 51st seat. It's not over or like shrug. Okay, Kamala Harris can just sit in that chair every time the Senate is in session and cast the tie-breaking vote. It's huge. It will make it easier to confirm nominees, to confirm judicial appointments. It also lets Kamala Harris do other things. She has another job. And so I think Democrats are getting hopped up about it. And I think Walker is such a disaster. Republicans will have a hard time getting excited about it.
What about the 80,000 people who voted for the Libertarian candidate? What will they do in the runoff? They did make it clear they did not want to vote for Herschel Walker, even if that meant electing Raphael Warnock.
I think they probably stay home. I think that Walker is a deeply unpopular character. He trailed Brian Kemp, the governor, the incumbent governor, by about 300,000 votes. So without Kemp on the ticket, running by himself, with more energized Democrats, God knows what kind of scandals we're going to hear about in the 3 weeks to come. I just don't think there's a whole lot of excitement about him.
Let's talk about the campaign that Herschel Walker did run. You were there. I just called him unqualified and problematic. That doesn't really cover what is the problem with him.
Well, he admits that he once threatened to kill his wife. He admits that he seemingly forgot that he had fathered three or four kids that hadn't ever appeared on his campaign biographies. He denies that he coerced two women into abortions, but they're both pretty credible women, and many people believe them.
He did pay for those abortions.
He's just a nice man.
That's it.
I think that's all it is. I think that a lot of people held their nose. But if you look at Kemp, a lot of Republicans couldn't bring themselves to vote for Herschel Walker. And I don't see what changes that. So, yeah, I'm pretty optimistic about the runoff.
I saw that Herschel Walker opened his runoff campaign by accusing Raphael Warnock of stoking racism, driving up crime, hating the military, and misrepresenting the Bible. I wonder if you have any comment.
Well, Reverend Warnock is actually a reverend. He runs the church that Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. used to run, a storied Ebenezer Baptist Church. He's a scholar. So that's ridiculous. One thing about the Warnock campaign that was interesting, I think he knew that he was probably headed for a runoff. And the closing days of the campaign anyway, where when I saw him, he was really hyping his work for the military, his work to keep open military bases and shore up military bases. Georgia's a very military state. His work on behalf of veterans and farmers. It was not as much of an appeal to the base as one might have expected or that you even saw earlier in the campaign. He really highlighted his bipartisan work. So this just doesn't land.
Yeah, I saw that Reverend Warnock began his runoff campaign with this statement, quote, "This race is about competence and it's about character. The choice between me and Herschel Walker is clear. Some things in life are complicated. This isn't one of them."
Very good. He was a little bit reticent to hit Walker on the character issues, but in the closing days, he did it a few times. I guess I didn't even know about this, John. He claimed to be a police officer with his fake badges. He's not a police officer. Apparently he had a business that actually didn't really exist. I mean, there are so many problems with him, his competence and his character. And I think Warnock was a little bit reluctant to go all in on that. And I saw his campaign manager quoted as saying something like, we wanted to keep the reverend, above the fray, a good Christian man who's not going to tear down his brother. But I think, I don't know that he's going to tear him down. I think he's just going to talk truth about him somewhat more. I think he has to in this runoff.
Well, the Republican campaign obviously can't argue on the merits that Herschel Walker is a qualified and competent candidate. Their argument has to be that a vote for Herschel Walker is a vote against Joe Biden. They have to kind of nationalize this. But since the Democrats will control the Senate, whatever happens in Georgia, that's not really a very convincing or powerful argument at this point.
Yeah, and I think Herschel Walker will get really tripped up explaining to you what I explained a little while ago about how 149 gives the Democrats a lot more power to specifically confirm Biden nominees and also, takes power out of the hands of Joe Manchin and here's some power out of the hands of Manchin and or Sinema. I think that's going to be a tough thing for him to explain.
And I want to talk about the money factor here. The Georgia Senate race was the most expensive single campaign in 2022, Warnock raised $99 million for the November campaign and spent $76 million. Walker raised only $37 million and spent $32 million. And most of all this money went on TV ads. If you add in the independent groups, I read $195 million was spent on radio and TV ads. And now, of course, our email boxes are filled this morning with appeals for more money, which they probably are going to spend on more negative TV ads. Haven't Georgians seen enough negative TV ads in the last month for a lifetime? Are another 3 weeks of negative ads going to change any votes?
It's easy to criticize negative ads, but often they work. One thing I will say about the TV spending, a lot of grassroots people were, to put it artfully, kind of pissed off about it. They felt like it would have been better spent by both the Abrams and Warnock campaign, but particularly Warnock. Some of it would be better spent on shoring up the network of grassroots groups that helped. They weren't solely responsible for the runoff wins in 2021, but they felt like they got a lot less attention, a lot less attention was placed on the ground game. And all this money went to TV ads, which, also means it goes to the Democratic consultants who buy the TV ads and make the TV ads and purchase the TV ads. So it left a little bit of a negative taste in people's mouths. And I don't know what the holidays coming up will have to do with it, but I think there is something like, oh, my God, we don't want to be seeing all this negativity as we're trying to you know, get ready to for the most wonderful time of the year, which I don't consider it that. I prefer fall, but, you know, that's what people say.
Yeah, turnout is going to be everything. In December. And it is true, negative ads might depress the turnout of your opponent a little bit, but really, it's the individual contact to be sure that your base and your supporters get to the polls, send in their mail ballots. That is what's going to win right. This race. It is my humble opinion, not more TV ads. And I'm sure lots of people in Georgia feel the same way.
Definitely.
We have to talk about the Trump factor here. What can you tell us about Trump's place in the runoff?
I expect all of this naysaying from other Republicans that's happened in the last week since the election results were clear, that blaming it on him somehow, that's not going to make him back down. That's going to make him run. I think that's very bad for Herschel Walker. I think the more Trump is top of mind, the worse it is for Walker. I think Trump will also, whatever he does, very much want to go to Georgia. And I think that would also be bad for Herschel Walker. Trump is a chaos agent and a dangerous guy. And I think he will play a role in this runoff. And I don't think that will be good for Walker either.
Now we hear a little bit of a dog crying in the background there. Say a few words about your wonderful dog.
Sadie, why are you whining? My wonderful dog is Sadie. If you follow me on Twitter, you know Sadie very well.
Yes.
A very healthy, happy 13 and a half. But whenever I start talking on the phone, or especially Zoom calls, which we're doing, she just gets very jealous and the whining begins. If you hear whining, she's not being mistreated. She's just a little jealous. She didn't like me being in Georgia.
She really picked up a lot when you mentioned Trump, I noticed.
She definitely did. I think that's probably what it is.
And then there's one other Trump-related factor in both the regular November election and now the December runoff. Trump told Republicans in 2020 not to trust voting by mail and not to trust the voting machines where you vote in person, because there's this, you know, gigantic world conspiracy against him. How much do you think that might have affected Republican voting in Georgia this year?
I don't know, but we know it had I wrote about this at the time. It had a clear effect on the 2021 runoff. Turnout was really depressed in a lot of the white, rural, Trumpy counties. People listened to him. People said, Biden stole the election. Why should we trust this one? I saw a really interesting thing in the exit polling that Brian Kemp's voters were very, very likely, I want to say 70%, thought that it was possible the election had been stolen. They didn't believe that Biden was the president. So I think there is an undercurrent of, we still can't trust elections. And we came out for Brian Kemp. But I think the combination of demoralization, it's not going to make a difference in who controls the Senate, lingering doubts about Walker, his overall unpopularity, and let's say it, perhaps some good old racism. They just might not be able to get out there right after Thanksgiving and before Christmas for, you know, that guy. So I don't know.
Finally, we have to talk about Stacey Abrams. She lost, as you said, for a second time by a bigger margin than the first time. Over the past decade, she's responsible for bringing hundreds of thousands of new voters to the polls. She built this huge voter registration and turnout machine that helped Joe Biden carry Georgia in 2020, helped the state elect its first Jewish and Black senators, John Ossoff and Raphael Warnock. That gave Democrats control of the Senate. You know, Stacey Abrams in 2020 saved Joe Biden, saved the Senate, really saved America, you know, saved the world from Donald Trump, really. She lost this time for many reasons. Probably the most important is she's running against an incumbent who actually people liked, for partly for the good reasons that he stood up to Trump and refused to reverse the election results in Georgia in 2020. I noticed that Brian Kemp also, just months before the election, gave $350 of state money to every poor person in Georgia. You think that helped?
Oh, I think that helped a lot. I think, you know, he did cut taxes. He did, you know, mostly went to rich people, but poor people did see something. You've got to mention sexism. I'm sorry. We have a really hard time electing female executives. I mean, Kathy Hochul was reelected, which is great, in New York. But in general, that level job is tough. for women to get, and especially Black women. And so I think there was some of that. There was also a sense, and I don't really know how to take this or how to put it, but I heard it from even her allies that her national presence, she became a star even in losing. And as much as she did for the Democratic Party, at the same time, you know, she gave the 2019 State of the Union rebuttal against Trump. She pretty much put herself out there running for vice president. If a man did that, would that be so bad? I don't know. But I think she was punished by it. And there was a sense that she got a lot of money from outside the state, that she really had become a national celebrity. And her ground game was criticized, too. I mean, people didn't think it was as robust. We're going to be looking at the numbers and talk. I'm going to be talking to people to try to report this out a little better. But that's what I heard on the ground. But it was very depressing. I admire her. I look forward to what she does in the future. And I do think she deserves supreme credit for what she pulled off in 2018, as well as 2020 and 21.
Yeah. And just big picture, if I'd asked you, you know, a couple of years ago, what would happen in Georgia if a Black woman challenged the white man who was the incumbent governor in a state where Black people are 30% of the population, in a country where no Black woman has ever been elected governor, what would you say?
She's brave. No, girl. No, you know, just describing it that way is really tough. But she was Stacey Abrams. And I don't want to criticize Senator Warnock for this. He did better than she did. But there was a sense, there was some distance between them. They didn't campaign up together very often. There was a sense that he was distancing himself somewhat, that he knew that his lane was more down the middle. And people had some mixed feelings about that as well. I reported on 2020 and 21 in Georgia from my COVID home office. I didn't get to go there. And I really would have expected that 2022 would have been this gorgeous coming together of, you know, everyone, the multiracial coalition, and, you know, Abrams and Warnock together and Ossoff together everywhere. And that definitely didn't happen. Ossoff campaigned with her a fair amount.
The big question is, what's next for Stacey Abrams?
I have no idea. I'm hoping to talk to her this week. I hope she takes a really great vacation. Well, she can't take a great vacation because she's got to be out there working for the Reverend.
And are you going back to Georgia for the runoff?
We'll see. Sadie says no.
Sadie says no. Joan Walsh, read her reports on Georgia at thenation.com. Joan, thanks for talking with us today.
Thanks, John. It was fun.
Now it's time to talk about what happened in the election in Southern California, starting with the sheriff. The LA County Sheriff has more than 10,000 sworn deputies and 8,000 more employees to police the biggest county in the country, 10 million people, and the biggest jail system in the world, known for its horrible conditions. The sheriffs in California are elected, and in 2018, an incumbent sheriff in LA was defeated for the first time in more than a century, and LA County elected its first Latino sheriff in modern history, Alex Villanueva. He was a reformer supported by the ACLU and all the forces of good in Southern California. But then he became the biggest political problem we had in LA because he did all the things he promised not to do. Now he's up for re-election. For comment, we turn to Gustavo Arellano. He's an indispensable columnist for the LA Times, covering, as he says, Southern California everything. He describes himself as the child of two Mexican immigrants, one of whom came to this country in the trunk of a Chevy. Gustavo Arellano, welcome back.
Gracias as always, John.
So in the election, the challenger in the sheriff's race, former Long Beach Police Chief Robert Luna, increased his lead over the incumbent Villanueva. Currently, as we speak on Tuesday, it's 60% for Luna, 40% for Villanueva, with 70% of the vote counted.
On election night, I was there at Robert Luna's celebration party in Long Beach, which was alongside another Robert, Robert Garcia, who just won his congressional race, first gay immigrant in Southern California, I believe. He's Latino from Peru, to get into Congress, former mayor of Long Beach. The initial result had Luna up by 55%. Then it shrunk a little bit. So I thought, oh, this is going to be tighter. This is going to be as tight as the mayoral race. But no, Luna has just been increasing his lead. Every single result so far since Election Day, every single update has shown Luna increasing his lead. And I would think, though, more tellingly, there was also a measure that LA County voters voted on that gave the Board of Supervisors the power to remove any sitting sheriff with a 4/5 supermajority. That one from the start has been overwhelmingly approved by, I think the last count was 70% of the voters. So there's definitely antagonism by LA, most of LA County against Villanueva, and they went to the ballot box and proved it.
Assuming now that Villanueva concedes one of these days and
sure.
Robert Luna becomes the sheriff, what kind of sheriff do you think he will be? For starters, let's talk about the jails. As I said, the LA sheriff runs the largest jail system in the world. The ACLU here has been suing the sheriff about the jails for, I don't know, 40 years or something like that. The latest lawsuit, the ACLU won in September when a federal court judge ordered LA County to fix the jail's inmate reception center, the IRC, after the lawyers for the sheriff conceded there was horrific treatment of people confined at the jail's booking facility. Attorneys for the ACLU found people chained to chairs for days, dozens sleeping head to head on concrete, open defecation, no sanitation, medication withheld, people with mental health needs waiting for days in the IRC because there's no more jail beds available. Do you think the new sheriff, Robert Luna, will fix the jails?
Oh, geez. This is a department that, when was it not a reign of terror? I mean, you go back to ever. I think just sheriff's departments in general, I have a general antipathy toward departments like that, and especially the people at the top. Something about that position makes folks drunk with power. And then that's my columnist voice. My objective voice says this is a department where just three sheriffs ago with Lee Baca went to federal prison along with his undersheriff for corruption. Jim McDonald, who was a former sheriff of Long Beach or former police chief of Long Beach, Robert Luna's former boss, he got elected for one term because the deputies turned on him because he was trying to make some reform. So Luna comes in, inherits all the problems that McDonald and also even Villanueva tried to fix. And on top of that, has a deputies union that was against them, has deputy gangs that are still part of the LA Sheriff's Department, have activists who are not happy with Luna because at the Long Beach Police Department, Luna had his own controversies. His department was using like a text messaging system that immediately deleted text, didn't save him at all. And Luna said, oh, that was our mistake. We didn't do it. But people accused him of trying to not be transparent. During the protests of George Floyd, Long Beach Police Department officers, they fired non-lethal weaponry at reporters. Adolfo Guzman Lopez from KPCC got hit into the neck. Cerise Castle from Knock It LA also got hit. And Luna never really said much about it. So he's going to have critics from left and right. By all accounts, Luna himself is a nice guy. But the people who even support him, they've told me that you don't need a nice guy right now to try to reform this department. And also, I have to say, we kind of heard this story 4 years ago, a Democrat coming in saying he's going to upend the incumbency and selling everyone a message of I am not the incumbent. I am more liberal than incumbent. And we all know what happened with Villanueva.
What about his relationship with the LA County DA, George Gascón, who is a famous leader of progressive district attorneys in the United States? Gascón just sent out an email saying that a criminal justice reform advocate is leading in the race for LA sheriff. Villanueva, of course, was a declared enemy of LA's progressive DA. Do you think when Robert Luna becomes the new sheriff, he's going to have a friendly working relationship with our progressive DA?
Luna, from the start, has said you need to have a working relationship with all the arms of LA County government when you're the sheriff. If you cannot attack, you cannot be at odds with people just because you don't like them. And of course, there's going to be clashes. He comes in as a nice guy, but at the end, he's still the head of the sheriff's department. He's going to have to win over his deputies first before anyone else. With Gascon, yes, he is a leader of having a more progressive district attorney's offices across the country. On the other hand, his office just announced that they declined to file charges against the deputies who shot and killed DeJean Kizzy, a black man whose death led to a lot of protest. And there's a lot of these other things there. I mean, it'll remain to be seen what Luna does, because he had his own police department in Long Beach have to pay out millions of dollars in wrongful death lawsuits. It's going to happen. I mean, these things happen again and again. I will say on election night, though, he told his audience, which were progressives, friends of mine who were there, deputies wearing the Blue Lives Matter little pin on their lapels. And he said, like, I'm paraphrasing here, but I'm the type of sheriff that when something goes wrong, I look myself in the mirror and I ask myself, basically tell myself it's on me. So that's better than Villanueva, who blamed everyone on the planet except himself and the chip on his shoulder.
And then let's talk about the LA mayoral race. That, of course, between Karen Bass, a member of Congress, former head of the Congressional Black Caucus, former community organizer in South LA. She currently has 52% of the vote, while billionaire developer and former Republican Rick Caruso has 48%. Officially, it's still rated too close to call, but everybody is now saying Karen Bass will win. LA will get its first woman mayor. Rick Caruso famously spent $100 million of his own money. He targeted the Latino vote. Here you have expertise that we really need. I've heard from you that he did not just spend his $100 million on ads on Spanish language media, that he actually had a genuine ground game in Latino neighborhoods. Tell us about that.
Well, look, when you're a billionaire and you could spend $100 million of your own money, you're going to hire some of the best and brightest in the business. And they wisely told Rick, you just can't write checks and do ads from, the Grove or the brand at Americana. So Rick was pounding that pavement. I mean, he went to Boyle Heights, the very famous Latino neighborhood right next to East LA, at least 7 times, spending hours talking to business people. I went to one of his events there, and I could tell you that the love for him there was real. It's interesting because, of course, across the country, people are saying that Latinos save democracy by going for the Senate, the Democrats in both Arizona and Nevada. But in Los Angeles, at least, it'll remain to be seen how Latinos finally voted, because the polls leading up to the race, literally the weekend before Election Day by the LA, well, sponsored by the LA Times, but done by Berkeley, showed Latinos as the only ethnic group that supported Rick Caruso for mayor and also that supported Alex Villanueva for sheriff. If that holds, I think it's going to be a very fascinating analysis of what happened, because look, LA still, use whatever shade of blue, of deep blue that you like. Was it emerald blue, aqua blue? I'm not good with colors, but it is. It absolutely is very, very blue. But if Latinos, who are a majority of the residents in LA County now, I think still a minority of the votes, except by, I think about 35%, if they went for the more conservative Democrat, what does that tell us about Latino voters in one of the most liberal areas, big cities in the United States?
Yeah. And of course, it's been a Republican dream, at least since Nixon, that Latinos should support Republicans in part because the blacks support the Democrats. Ever since Nixon, Republicans have said, Latinos should be more conservative. They should be more Republicans, because the stereotype is they're more family oriented than black people. They're more hardworking than black people. They're more Catholic. They have more self-reliance than black people. This is all the stereotype that Republicans have built on. And of course, as you say, LA is Democratic, but Rick Caruso was a Republican until a couple of years ago. As you say, this is a key testing ground for the longer term Republican, decades old conservative strategy of recruiting Latinos as out of antagonism to blacks in part.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the Republican Party has always tried to do that, especially with Latinos. Ronald Reagan, he didn't say it. Actually, it was one of his advisors, but famously associated with him saying Latinos are Republicans. They just don't know it yet. And I have always maintained there's an element, a big element of truth to that, except that the Republicans screwed it up for the past quarter century by pursuing xenophobic policies. The fact, yes, that even Trump was able to gain more votes from Latinos in 2020, and that the Latino percentage now that go for Republicans, like 39%, even in this supposed red trickle, I think that still says a lot. But imagine if the Republican Party wasn't so fascist, wasn't so against democracy, didn't support such whack job candidates across the country, and had maintained a semblance of normalcy for at least the past 20 years. I mean, look, we're now in a part where George W. Bush got about 40% of Latino vote, and he was advocating for amnesty. Imagine if the Republican Party continued that way. Latinos would have been the Irish and Italians of a previous generation, the ones who were so for Kennedy and by Reagan had forsaken the Democratic Party largely for good. But hey, that's all on Republicans. And all, you know, I would also say so on Democrats as well for not being, for keeping Latinos as just, yeah, of course you're going to vote for us. So why should we even bother with you folks? You know, you cannot ever just think someone's going to be there for you.
And just one footnote, we always have to remind our listeners, Latinos are not a single unified group. The Latinos of Los Angeles County are primarily Mexican Americans and Central Americans. That's not the case in Florida.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, Florida, of course, is ruby red Republican now because of Latinos, Venezolanos, basically refugees from what they say are like socialist demons, whether it's, you know, Castro, Hugo Castro back in the day, Nicolas Maduro, the Castros, of course, in Cuba and elsewhere. But yeah, that's a completely different thing. But also, I would say in Southern California, you have those Mexican-Americans like myself who grew up with, you know, what I call Rancho Libertarianism, where your families did come from rural areas. Rural areas, almost anywhere, at least in Mexico, are going to be a little bit more individualistic, a little bit more libertarian. But then once we come up here and you hear Republicans calling your uncles and parents invaders, you have Democrats taking us for granted. Well, yeah, you're probably going to go Democrat, but you're not going to be beholden to Democrats. And I, you know, well, again, I we're only a week away. Week after election day. So in a couple of weeks, we'll have more results, more people just putting the screws on the election results and putting them geographically and ethnically. I can't wait for that.
One other race in Southern California I want to talk about in Orange County. Our candidate, Katie Porter, seems like she will be reelected, but there was a very disturbing defeat for Democrats, the victory of an incumbent Republican, Michelle Steele, who's Korean-American, over Jay Chen, the Democrat who's Taiwanese-American. This is the race where the Republicans ran a TV ad that featured actors portraying Chinese Communist Party intelligence officers saying about the Democratic candidate, quote, "He's one of us, a socialist comrade who even supported Bernie Sanders for supreme leader," one man says. And there's a photo of the Chinese Communist president on the wall behind them. And then a title appears, "Jay Chen, he's perfect for communist China." And the two men throw their heads back and erupt in maniacal laughter. Gustavo, is Jay Chen perfect for communist China?
Of course not. And he's also a veteran. So shame on Michelle Steele for pursuing those pathetic tactics. But there's no surprise. Her husband is Sean Steele, former chair of the California Republican Party. So he's someone who knows trash politics because he is trash politics. When Michelle Steele also, her district is very bizarre. It was redistricted in 2020 or, you know, 2020. So for this one, this is the first time she's running for it. And it basically goes from Little Saigon, so the capital of Vietnam, of the Vietnamese diaspora in the United States, if not the world, and then goes upward and extends out to Fullerton. So it's a very Asian district. It was created like that. Also with her fellow Korean American Republican Congresswoman, Young Kim, these were two districts that were created specifically with having an Asian American representative in mind. So what Michelle did is just, I mean, you would remember this more than me, out of the days of Bob Dornan and these old school caveman Republican politics that sadly still have an audience in Little Saigon, which is fervently anti-communist, fervently also immigrant, so buys into that stuff. I mean, I have to say, even in like more Latino areas of Southern California, I saw campaign mailers who had that sort of, I mean, I hate to say, just cheap politics, black and white, blurry photos of people making all sorts of ad hominem attacks. They work, especially when you have an uninformed electorate that is not paying attention. So shame on Michelle and shame on the voters who voted for her. But hey, it's Orange County. Republican Party didn't make the comeback that they wanted to, but they're still alive. This was not the death knell for the Republican Party just yet. So Orange County remains purple and Orange County remains a place where people are going to be fighting.
Gustavo Arellano, the indispensable columnist for the LA Times. Gracias, Gustavo.
Gracias to you, John.
Start Making Sense, a podcast from The Nation magazine, is co-produced by the LA Review of Books and recorded in Los Angeles at our Blythe Avenue studios. Renee Reynolds is our associate producer. Alan Minsky is our producer. Ludwig Hurtado is our executive producer. D.D. Guttenplan is editor of The Nation. Bhaskar Sunkara is president of The Nation. And Katrina Vandenhoevel is publisher and editorial director of The Nation. Our theme music is from Barcelona Afrobeat, licensed by Creative Commons. You can find out more about Start Making Sense at thenation.com and subscribe to Start Making Sense on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm John Wiener. Thanks for listening.